in the latter part of 44 and January, February, March of 45, we tried, we would try every way we could to catch these 252s. One of them was shot down by somebody in our wing, but almost by accident. I always felt that I had nicked one. We would anticipate when we were in Holland at a little aerodrome called Grouw, we were always being attacked by these 252s when the sky was clear, when there was no clouds about. So we knew that on a sunny day there would be two or three of these coming down. And we had lost a number of ground crew and some pilots and a lot of aircraft because of air bombing. So we would deliberately, I would take the squadron and go on patrols and put one sort of circling the airport, the airfield, and one further on, anticipating that, when we, over the airfield, saw these fellows coming down, then we could warn the rest of the squadron we didn't know which way they would come, of course. But there was one time when we almost got there. We almost got one of them.
You mentioned earlier that you were over-cocky at times in your flying. Did that help you when you were in Dublin?
Well, I told you, quite frankly, I was not a very good shot. I was quite good. I was pretty good. I was good in attacking ground targets. But I quickly realized that, for me at any rate, I could, you know what deflection shooting is. When you get into a dogfight, you're going around in circles. You have to put your bullets in front of the enemy so that he flies into your bullets. He's going around like that, so you have to calculate where you're going to shoot. It's like duck shooting. I wasn't very good at that. And you would do that when you were 200, even 300 yards away, if you were good at it. But then I realized I was not good at it. The only thing I could do was to get as close, right up the bottom of these. If I got up, tried to wipe, cut off his tail, I could shoot down. So I got, I damaged them off because I was missing. But I did eventually shoot down six and another two probables. But all of them, when I was very, very close, in fact, too close, because I lost number two, my number two, who was right beside me, who flew right into the debris, the parts of the aircraft that I'd blown up, and he crashed and was killed. But other aircraft were all explosions right in front of me, 50 yards. Once, stupid man, but I wasn't able to. Once I chased him, I had pretty good eyesight. Once I saw it, when was this? 42, 43. I saw a single German aircraft. I thought it was a German aircraft. Away, not far away, but a little below us. And I reported it to the wing, the wing commander, Chadford, said we can't see it. And the CO of my squadron said, well, go and have a look for it. So I turned around and I went back. I was tail end Johnny that day, and I'd been filling in for somebody. And when I got to this back and I saw it was a Messerschmitt, flying along as though it were Sunday, all by himself, and right in the middle of France. We were 22,000 feet. And here was a single German aircraft, apparently hadn't seen us. And he must have been a new chap in the squadron. And he was probably up on a practice flight. So, but anyway, when I thought, oh, this is too good to be true. But when I got close to him, he looked around and he must have seen me. So way that he went down like that. So I went down like that after him, and we went down from 22,000 feet like that. But I was shooting all the time, but I was skidding. You see, when you're turning, you've got to, if you're skidding or going this way, your bullets aren't going the way you intend them. When I got down to the treetop level, he had to straighten out, and I straightened out. We were very close. I lined him up, pushed the button. There was no ammunition left. I used it all. Well, you do. When you get into a battle, I was very cool. But I was nervous and frightened many times, but never once you get into it. Anyway, I've got to do something. So I tried to frighten him into the ground. I got up very close to his tail, even thought of cutting off his tail with my propeller. Well, it was a stupid thing to do in the middle of France. So I flew up beside him. I was happy to see that I'd hit him with a couple of little holes in the fuselage. And we were flying formation. And he was looking at me, and I went like this. I wanted him to, I had the idea, well, better he put a few holes in me, then I'd get back home and I'd look better than it. Because, you know, you have a camera linked to your guns, and the camera goes off when you're shooting, and it reveals everything. Well, this camera would have seen me shooting, and it would probably not have seen the air. So anyway, I thought maybe it'd be better if I'd. But he, stupid little, must have been so frightened. Anyway, he didn't do anything. So I quickly came to my senses and flew back home. I got my fitter to not to give up the film. And I reported that I'd had a shot at things on the ground. But I could have, I think I did all of the, made all the mistakes in the world. But I learned. I think that I became a much wiser. And I was very proud of myself, the way I organized the squadron when we did attack ground targets, because I devised a number of ways of attacking ground targets to take the least risk of losing some of the pilots.
From your first mission to your last mission, what were the biggest differences, equipment-wise, experience-wise?
Yes, I suppose so. I wasn't aware of that. Yeah. You mean the equipment was better?
It obviously improved.
Yes. We had more power, we had more climbing ability, but I wouldn't run down the original Spit, the Spit 5. Flew it first. The 5A, I guess, had 8 machine guns only. It was the 5B that had cannons and the machine guns. Yes, the equipment was better.
My understanding is that one of the things attached to the air power is to protect other missions. Bombings would play an escort role. And a lot of, so you're protecting a lot of your fellow soldiers as they were bombing.
Well, in 41, 42, 43, in addition to the protecting bomber escorts, there were several types of missions. They called one a circus, which was a big mass of the squadrons. There was one of the names of them all. They had different names. One was protecting twin-engine Mitchells or Bostons or Marauders. Not very many of them. And they would carry a payload, and they would have a bombing target, usually an industrial plant or an aerodrome somewhere. But their main purpose was really not to do a bombing. It was to be a target to attract. We were flying in 43, then I'm thinking about 42, 43. We were trying to get the German Air Force up into the air. It was before, when they were still quite heavy on the ground, before they really started moving off to Russia and Italy. And so there was the, I would say, sweeps. We would have three or four wings, maybe more at different levels, who were just making, trying to inveigle the Germans to come up and do battle. We could have these bombers to as sort of bait, and then we would, or we would, there would be a heavier bomb load, we would protect the fortresses, the 4-inch fortresses, when they came back from bombing raids in Germany. This is after the Americans came over in 43. We couldn't go with the fortresses into Germany. It was, we couldn't go that far, but we could help to protect them when they got back within our range.
You took part in the liberation of France, Belgium, yes. Holland. What was that like going on D-Day?
I wasn't there on the actual D-Day. I was there a couple of weeks after, but we were still flying from fields up at the coast. That is, of course, the time when the Spitfire became, there weren't that many air battles then, but we were concentrating on chasing the, or trying to do as much damage to the German armed forces who were escaping out of western France, out of Cherbourg and the rest. And I arrived when we were at a place called the Falaise Gap. This is where the German army en masse were trying to get through a fairly narrow part of central Normandy. And they were first driving only at night and hiding up under in the forests or orchards or went during the day, and we would try to find them. And then as they got more desperate, they would start moving both that day and night. And that was when the Spitfire became a kind of dive bomber. I didn't like that work, but we became very good at it for 416 and 443.
Did you ever get onto the ground in France, Holland, or Belgium once you were, like, after you liberated them?
Oh yes, right from the beginning. Oh well, the devastation caused by the by the army and then the air force in all of northern Normandy was devastating. Caen, C-A-E-N, in particular, was a town that was almost completely destroyed. The only way to get the Germans out of the basements of was to pulverize the town. It wasn't pleasant at all, no. Yes, I visited a lot of them. Later on, I went into Paris about 3 days after our occupation of the city. I drove a group of pilots in by jeep, spending a whole day and a night visiting Paris. And as we drove in, we would be stopped and kissed and handed flowers and wine by the French citizens all along the roads into Paris. It was very moving.
And so you saw a lot of that in Belgium and Holland?
And yes, Belgium and Holland, yes. Holland, we had a lot of very heavy flying in Holland. I went with the Canadian delegation to the ceremonies last in May when they were celebrating the liberation of Holland. There were 19 Air Force people from Canada. I was one of them. And I was very, very moved by the gratitude of the Dutch people. And amazing how they still remember. The Dutch suffered a lot from the Germans, but they also suffered from starvation, real outright starvation at the end of the war. The Germans had taken everything from their fields because Germans in Germany were starving too. And when the Canadians liberated Holland, they at the same time flew in grains and other foods. And so the Canadians are remembered as liberators, but also as saviors as well. Well, every year, every 5 years, 10 years, special, they have these ceremonies, parades, and the rest. I was in a parade for 2.5 hours at, I forgot the name of the one of the main cities where, small city where the Queen lives. And there were, it was raining, it was snowing, it was wind, maybe there were, not snowing, but cold rain. And yet these masses of people lined the streets, on both sides of the street, for 3 hours, and children, and they were all shouting out, thank you, thank you, thank you, thank you. They were throwing flowers. Oh, and I got out of the lorry that I was in. I could hardly get out. It was so full of flowers.
Oh, really?
And all of these Dutch people telling their children talking to you. All that, so many of the Dutch people speak English, you know. They're better linguists. They're better in English and French and German than any other country in Europe. That was really a moving experience. No matter where you walked in Holland, people would come up to you and thank you as though you'd liberated them the week before. Mm-hmm. It was like that.
While you were in the Air Force, you became a squadron leader. What made you rise above the rest of that position?
Well, I think it was because I still lived. I was very, very lucky, you know. I don't know. Why did I become? Well, I was, as I say, I was flight commander 3 times. I should have learned enough to become a. I liked being a CO. I enjoyed the. I suppose it was a bit because I was older. I suppose. I don't know. But I liked. Encouraging people. I like stimulating people to. I flew under a most inspiring leader called Chad Chadburn. Wing Commander Chad Chadburn was killed 2 weeks after the invasion of France. An accident in the air. His number two collided with him. But he was 23 then. He was a wing commander at 23. Chad had that unique, charismatic something or other that made you delighted to follow him. When he briefed us, when he was as a wing commander, he would participate in the briefing before we'd go off on a show. Well, he always made those briefings like theater. He made us laugh. No matter how tough the show was going to be, after he finished talking, we were just full of high spirits. We were ready to do anything. It's difficult to say this about a man, but I think most of the pilots who flew under him loved Chad. They had a respect that went beyond just respect. He had this smile, this manner with, and he was such an unselfish. He didn't think about making. There were some leaders who did very well. I had a high score. I've flown with some of them who were good marksmen, but all they were interested in was getting a high score for themselves. You knew there was Chad. Chad was out to let everybody in the squadron get a shot at the enemy. He would see to it that everybody in the squadron of the wing was put in the right position. He never tried to advance his own cause. And he was awarded 2 DSOs for this kind of leadership. Well, if you, there was a saying we used to say that if ever you had a chance to fly with Chad, under Chad, there's always a bit of his spirit that remained with you. Well, I learned a lot from Chad, and I tried to model my own behavior on what he did. I didn't have the charismatic thing, but. I think I learned how to get to make people enthusiastic, and how to laugh, and I think that I think I probably contributed more on the ground from stimulating the people. Also, there was one thing that I did, I think, better than most. I always felt that the ground crew, the people who serviced our aircraft, the mechanics, the fitters, the armorers, I always felt that they were more important than we sometimes conceded or realized. And so I went out of my way to see to it the ground crew were involved in every party, everything we did. And one of the biggest parties we had, 443, was a, when we were at the lowest ebb, when our airfield was crowded, was flooded out. We were being attacked by these jets. The weather was awful. We were living in tents. And I was able to get a hold of 180 bottles of champagne. Sold them to everybody, invited the ground crew and the pilots, and we had it in this big tent, everybody wearing steel helmets and gum boots, and they all opened their bottles of champagne at the same time, and we had such a riotous evening that the morale went up just like that. It was
So you also had a lot of confidence in your ground crew, a lot of confidence in that.
Yes, and it made them, it was a selfish thing, because if they knew that the pilots appreciated their work, they'd work more diligently even. I didn't think of it that way, but this is what happened. We had, 443 had the best maintenance record of all of the three squadrons for all the time I was CO, because our ground crew were so determined to do as good a job as they could for us, because we, in turn, recognized them. And so it paid off.
More to the battles now, when, because you're a squadron leader, you have freedom to make decisions, which obviously command can't make. They don't know what the situation is when you're in the air. But what was it like knowing that you could possibly be sending one of your men to their death in a battle?
Oh, well, you mentioned battle before. You know, we've never used
mission, that. Sorry.
Yeah, a mission, yes, a project. No, I've never ever sent. We would. We had targets. We had general targets. We knew where the enemy line was and where the Allies' line was, and we were frequently out to try to harass the Germans, to attack. What we called railway interdictions. We would be assigned to beat up the yards, the rail yards, a certain center, because the Germans were expected that night to be sending armament or tanks through. And so you assigned. Yes, the squadron would be broken up into maybe a section of six or section of four to do certain things, but it was more or less automatic. You took your turn. You didn't. I was never sort of conscious of sending people into danger.
There's the risk to everyone.
The risk to everybody else.
When the war finally did end in May of 45, what was your feeling? Like, as I was saying, you're a pacifist. What was your feeling when the war finally did end?
I was on a ship from Liverpool to Halifax when the armistice was signed. I had left England. I had left in about 3 weeks before the end of the war. I had served a long, long time on both tours, and it was funny. You never knew when you were going to finish. In the case of a squadron leader, it would be the wing commander and the base commander who would decide when the squadron leader had done, when he had to go. Squadron leader would recommend when his flight commanders or his pilots were finished. You never told them before, because if you did, they would think about it. So you decided that you look through the logbook of your pilot or flight commander, and you look more at his behavior, because everyone reacted, people tired at a different rate. And some people, when they tired and got tense, became more courageous, more dangerous to their fellows. They were on the go, and when you weren't aware of it yourself, I guess, but somebody looking at you could see that. So when I went to the group captain and said that I wanted to turf, I wanted to ground a flight commander called Lloyd. He said, "Okay, Art," and I told him that I wanted to name Chuck Charlesworth, Jeff from Victoria now dead, as his replacement. The group captain said, "Okay, that's okay, Art." And I was just going out of his mobile command office, and he said, "You're finished too, Art." Yeah, you don't fly anymore. Well, he had known all the time that I was going. And, you know, I had so much experience in kicking other people out, I suddenly realized what he was after, because I was getting too damn brave, too, I was leading my men into trouble, you know, and I didn't give a darn anymore. I was just flying from going up whenever I could, and it was getting, but the group captain, a smart fellow who had been in operations himself, saw that. But then when I started back to the dispersal, and I had to tell the pilots that I was off, I just felt, I was so upset, so guilty, I ran back to the group captain's office. I said, "No, sir, I'm not going to quit. No, I'm not. No, you can't. I don't know. The squadron couldn't manage without me. I thought I was indispensable." Anyway, he laughed. He said, "No, you're finished. You know you're finished." So it bothered me. And then, so I, that night I had, with this other chap, Lloyd, they had a party for me. They both made us both drunk in about an hour. And we got up at 6 in the morning or 7 in the morning and flew back to England. When I got to England, though, I was so depressed, I was going mad. I was so angry, so guilty. Because by this time, I thought, here was just about the end of the war, and I'm leaving my squadron in the lurch. And they're not going to be able to manage without me. I was their chief. Well, how are they going to, they're not going to survive without me. Now it had certainly gone to my head. Anyway, I had some friends in England who very kindly took me out for a week in their place in the country, and they walked me every day, every night we'd go to the pub. And finally, after a week, I would sleep at night. I was so tired from walking. So I recovered. I had to go on the boat, and the war was at an end. I thought we would be going to Japan. I didn't think it was all over then. And it was when I got to Vancouver that the bombs dropped, the nuclear bombs.
Now that 60 years has passed since the war,
60,
almost 70 since you started your training, is there anything that you go back that you would do again, that you do differently?
Would I do again?
Would you still join the war knowing what you know now?
Yes. But I think what I would have done was, I would have ignored my mother. I was in England. I would have joined the. You see, I could have got into the Air Force, as an IRC, not for training as a flyer, but just as an airman, because there they would have had time to discover my past. But they wouldn't let me join the Air Force for a short service commission for air crew training, because they didn't know anything about me. But if I had had the time to come again, I'd have joined directly into the Air Force and taken my chance, and I think I could have talked myself into flying training. I wouldn't have survived, though.
No,
through the Battle of Britain, I'd be shot down. I would have been shot down, because I was lucky to have enough time to learn how to shoot. But I don't think if I'd gone directly in and then flown in May 1940, a year later, less than a year later, I doubt whether I would have survived. But I was always felt guilty about not squeezing my way into the RAF. That doesn't matter that much. I didn't have anything to do with the Air Force. I had about six of my flight commanders lived here in Vancouver and Victoria, and all of us felt the same way. We didn't want to wanted to forget the war. And so it was only when we got together did we talk about it. So I was not a member of any Veterans Association, and I then finally went overseas and worked with the UN for 20 years. And when I came back here 3 or 4 years ago, the CO, the then CO of 443 Squadron, heard of the paper or somewhere that I was here, and he invited me out, and it was then that I became involved in Air Force matters. So it was all these many, many years that where I had nothing to do with. I think that you've got all you need is 10 past 12 now.
Just a real quick question. Do you see all these movies?